You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, David Sennin-Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I chatted with Ati Heinla. He's the CEO and co-founder of the autonomous robot delivery company, Starship Technologies. Now, Starship was founded in Estonia in 2014, and I'm sure if you haven't seen their little robots buzzing around, you've probably seen it on social media. They're quite the phenomenon. Now, Ati is also known for his involvement with Skype, which I don't have to explain to any of you what Skype is. I'm sure its impact it had on the early days of digital communication. Ati and I chatted over the delivery robot's impact on the wider delivery ecosystem, the way that the robots have been implemented, not only in Europe, but in the US, and the environmental impact that they've had, if any. It was quite an interesting conversation. Ati was quite willing to chat over the intricacies over the company and technology and where he hopes to see cities and robots coinciding together in the future. So I hope you're looking forward to that. But before, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstar startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Hello, Ati, and welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me here. And I think this will be an interesting episode for everybody.
I hope so. I hope so. So before we get into the meat of the questions, I always give the guests a chance to introduce themselves, their company, who they are. They can usually do it better than I can, so I think it's for the best.
Right. Okay. So I am building Starship Technologies, which is automating logistics, automating transport in the world. We are creating this sort of future that you see in science fiction movies where you don't really see the delivery guys knocking on your door. You see things flying to you or things created out of thin air, things moving automatically in the world. That's what we are doing. There are other people like Waymo, for example, automating the movement of people in the world. We are automating the movement of stuff. So we do food and grocery delivery to people's doorsteps. We are the largest company in the world in this, like by far the number one. In fact, you know, I mentioned Waymo. We have about as many robots driving around as Waymo has cars, and we have done a similar number of miles and more than 9-10 million deliveries. So we have lots of experience in this. And in terms of what I did before, my background is software engineering. My mother taught me how to program computers, and I was on the founding team of Skype and a few other startups as well. So I've done already a revolution or helped do a revolution in one industry, which is telecom, and now doing the same in transportation.
Great. It's an impactful portfolio. Let me tell you, just with that, I think it's interesting enough if you hadn't done anything else. But of course, we're here to talk about Starship today, and I am very interested. But before we get into the company itself, and you briefly mentioned this about how you started as a programmer and an early age. I saw somewhere that you wrote your first program at age 10. I think if I saw that right, which is impressive in and of itself. And I've read about your video game development time as well. I even found a playable version of Cosmonaut online, which I actually had a lot of fun with. It was surprising because it reminded me of a mobile game. You know, it reminded me of what's so popular now that you could just get on your phone and, you know, Flappy Bird or all these things that even had this kind of element where you could just spend hours into it. So it was quite interesting. So with your background on this, I just kind of want to hear about what pulled you first into the realm of programming, computer program, and what kept you interested in it.
Right. So I definitely had technology interest, you know, from early age. I was curious about, you know, how machines work and potentially how to build machines. And I grew up in a family of software developers. So my parents were both computer programmers. They met at the workplace. This topic was in my childhood all the time. Sometimes my parents worked on these big computers that were filling a whole room, and the time of these computers was really precious. So sometimes they had, you know, they were, these computers were booked, like, I'm not sure, was it 24/7, but sometimes they needed to have evenings in, you know, at the workplace, and you know they collected me from kindergarten and took me to their work, and they were working, and I was playing around with punch cards, and I grew up, you know, among these noises of these tape drives just quietly spinning, and you know, air-conditioned rooms, all of this stuff. My first interest actually as a child in terms of technology was electronics, but I was just reading a few books on it. I don't think I was actually good at building anything with my hands, really. But then when my mother actually, at some point when I was 10 years old, came home one day and said, hey, after, you know, I'll teach you something new. I'll teach you some of the basics of programming. And it looks like I was a pretty good learner, or pretty quick learner. So I actually learned some of the basics very, very quickly. And I became hooked instantly. Because I had been reading electronics books, but then it's somewhat hard. I mean, you have all of these physical skills, you know, you need to have this sort of mental engineering skills of being able to understand how transistors and capacitors work. At the same time, you need to be good at actually, you know, soldering things together. And it was a high bar for like an 8-year-old me or something like that. But the software development, I mean, the physical machines had already been built. I needed to just have something in my mind to imagine how this program would work and put that on paper in the language the computer would understand. And I kind of felt that I became so powerful. I could make the computer to do lots of different things. I became hooked instantly. Started, you know, using my imagination of what kind of programs I could write, what kind of things I could do. So that's what drew me into it.
And I guess we're all indebted really to your parents then, because then along comes your involvement with Skype. And if I think back to my childhood, Skype was probably the first tech company I knew about that wasn't American. It was just so global, so instantly, and everybody used it. I was raised in the States, but all my family was in Spain, and I remember using Skype to be able to talk to them. That was kind of, you know, so new at the time for me. I was like, and nobody really, and I had to teach them how to install on their computer. But then when we finally got it, you know, I was able to kind of create a dialogue. So I think Skype is in everybody's early life easily, because it really was a first tech company that was pushing something forward, and it wasn't American, which I think came as a surprise to probably many people. So, you know, speaking on Skype, I just kind of want to hear, because eventually you move on from Skype, you go into Starship. What lessons did you bring from your experience in developing Skype into the company that you're running now?
So Skype was actually a company, even though it became a global success very quickly. And when we actually started it, it was really odd to a lot of people. Like, are you really going to be, are people really going to be talking to each other via their computers? Computers. I mean, that's not used for talking to each other. Also, phones already exist. I mean, what problem are you solving? The phones already exist. Secondly, you know, back then, most computers, it was a long time ago, right? It was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. Back then, most computers were desktop computers. Desktop computers typically did not have microphones. So, wait a minute, computers don't have microphones. How could this become big? I mean, luckily, first, the laptop revolution just started approximately at the same time. And laptops had microphones built in. So that was one thing. Secondly, also people with desktops went out and bought headsets to be able to use Skype, right?
Right.
And long-range calls were quite expensive. I mean, they were metered by the minute or by the second. And
yes,
when you give people something for free that you used to be paying for, and it was actually also a product that you couldn't use alone. When you became a Skype user, you needed to go out and seek out, you know, your friends that you would want to talk to. You know, if you are in the US, you're going to seeking out your relatives or friends in Spain and so forth. So these things helped help to do the popularity of Skype. It really took off. We really did it pretty well. I think we were also really lucky in that other people could also have done pretty much very similar thing and ended up doing that, you know, which is also, I think, a reason why, you know, there was loads of competition, you know, lots of time later. And in the end, you know, when COVID happened, then it was actually Zoom that got the big boost, I think, from COVID and not Skype. And yeah, you know, Skype is no more. Microsoft decided to shut it down. Not because it wasn't popular. I think Microsoft certainly could have done also a better job in growing Skype, but who am I to tell? I only spent 5 years in Skype, 5.5 years in Skype. And the rest, you know, 15 or 20 years was without me, where other people were doing things. Easy to criticize from the side.
Right, right. Well, that's interesting, really. And like you're saying, I mean, it does feel like even what we're doing now, you know, speaking remotely through Riverside and everything, Skype set the groundwork for that in the sense of normalizing what it could be and making it work. And then, of course, COVID happens and other companies take it forward. But I think the legacy cemented. There's no doubt about it. So you've spoken here about kind of identifying why it worked and what people were looking for. So then what was that like in Starship? At what point was there a realization that you said, there's a gap here, there's something that's missing and I can do it?
Yeah, that realization was very much in the beginning, because it was the pivotal point was that that we just realized that hey, we can do this. Hey, it is possible to automate deliveries. It is possible to automate transport of stuff in the world. It is possible to create this science fiction future where things are moving by themselves whenever you want and so forth, and more efficiently than with people and so forth. I think it has been in the minds of people for a very long time, that it has been in their imagination that's something that will happen sometime in the future. I think people probably think it's happening in 20 years or 50 years or something like that. It's actually happening very much right now. But people have had this dream for a very long time. And in fact, transportation, and particularly last mile delivery, you could argue it's actually the last industry in the world where it is not automated. Like in most other things, you don't really get one person doing some job just for you. You have that, you know, this is like a, there used to be lumberjacks in the forest cutting down trees, for example, and now there's somebody driving a harvester, but they're driving a machine which does this job much more quickly and so forth. But they're still, of course, there overseeing things and so forth. But in delivery, it's still this one person carrying your burger and so forth. It's usually not one person, you know, sitting behind like a screen, you know, overseeing a fleet of hundreds of robots or thousands of robots, which is what's happening in Starship right now. We also have people in our operations, but these people are overseeing loads of things, loads of robots, and loads of deliveries happening, thousands of deliveries happening, instead of actually, you know, a person doing a delivery by themselves. So it's a different level of job, I would say. And we realized, the pivotal moment, we realized the technologies are there to do it. Just like with Skype, people saying that, you know, hey, you know, are people really going to be talking to computers and phones already exist? You know, there were a lot of people in the beginning who thought that that robot deliveries are not going to work, or it's really, really a long shot. Nowadays, after a decade of development, I think we have convinced everybody that it's very much a reality. And that's why, for example, I think almost all of the major delivery apps in the Western world are our customers, Starship customers, almost all. It's easier to name one or two that are not our customers than to list all of the delivery apps that are our customers, because they all believe that this is what they should be doing. They all have an automation strategy. They're all very much looking into it. And not just the delivery apps, but also the retailers, particularly grocery retailers. So a lot of our business is with grocery retailers.
So how do you see this impacting? Well, what is the vision for the impact that you look for Starship to have on logistics systems, delivery drivers? What is the goal with Starship if you get everybody to adopt and to kind of get these autonomous robots going?
Yeah. So we have created a whole system for autonomous logistics at scale. It's not that we have created this one robot that we can do demos with or something like that. We have created the whole system of thousands of robots running around and transporting things. You say that, hey, I want this to be something to be delivered from point A to point B. Our API tells you, yeah, that's, the robot will be there in 7 minutes. It will cost about this much. And businesses are using that all the time. And in Finland, it's actually nationwide coverage that we have had. So Finland's actually a country where it's not that the majority of last mile deliveries are done with robots yet. It's about 10%. But food and grocery same day deliveries in Finland is about 10% that is done by Starship. So Finland is an example of what also it will be in other countries, where we have nationwide coverage. Everybody in Finland knows our robots. Like, we are very much a fixture that, you know, people are very much aware of. And we work with the largest grocer in the country. And if you go to their app and want to order for same day delivery, you always get our robots. They don't have their own human courier network. They just use our robots. And we have several customers that are doing the same as well in other countries, and that is a blueprint for the whole world. It's not the case that the human couriers will just completely disappear. That's not the case. I think clearly our robots are not suitable for all of the deliveries. We only do the relatively short range, like literally a couple of miles or 4 kilometers or so. And we do these relatively smaller size of deliveries. I mean, we're not going to be delivering a piano. It just doesn't fit into the robot. But a couple of grocery bags absolutely does fit into the robot, and that's what we're doing very well.
That was really my next question, is the impact you feel it's going to have and is having on these kind of delivery drivers, which, you know, is its own kind of whole problem. I mean, here we're based in Spain right now. This EU Startups is based in Spain, and Glovo has had quite a few difficulties with its riders and riders' law and how to identify them. So it's an interesting topic to kind of think about the impact, because I'm sure that can be a critique, right? Because maybe some people are saying this is a God honest job for his people, that it's very easy to pick up, and your robots are replacing that.
I don't think we are actually replacing. I don't actually think that the number of human couriers in the world will ever decrease. I think the appetite for people to get delivery and affordable delivery just increases, and the robots will be taking some of this increase. But I don't think actually the number of human couriers will actually decrease.
Okay. Well, and this is a side note, but I am curious, how much of a problem is there of people attacking these robots or vandalizing them? Or, because I have to imagine that there has to be people who see a little robot going down the street and kick it or do something to it.
That's one of these things where, you know, people don't have microphones and, you know, that phones already exist. Like, I've had that question from day one. All the time. It seems, and these questions always come from people sitting in offices. So I think somehow people sitting in offices are really aggressive and really violent, and and think that these robots will be stolen and everything. That's not the case, actually. With human delivery drivers. Like, suppose they drive a car. Like, there's like also FedEx or DHL pulls up with a van. I mean, you could go and puncture the tires of a FedEx van. Sure, you could do that. And I'm sure it happens, like, once per million deliveries, maybe, you know. But have you done it? How many times you have done it?
No. I haven't thought about doing it yet.
Exactly. You have not done it, but you ask about it. You think that, that's going to be a big thing, but I've never encountered a person who says that, I do that for fun. I do that all the time. Like, I've never encountered that, but people think that others do that all the time. That's not the case. You know, we have done millions and millions and millions of deliveries. Like, we have not had really that problem. Yeah, I'm sure sometimes very rarely things happen, but but it's not an issue really. It's like delivery is an interesting business in the sense that you really get to experience the real world, like loads of long tail situations happening, loads of situations happening, all sorts of interesting things and combinations of things happening that you don't necessarily think of, we can't possibly anticipate in our technology everything that can happen, but we need to have safe handling of also all sorts of long tail situations. Nice thing is, any unusual thing happen, robot driving on the sidewalk can just stop and take its time to investigate the situation and think, you know, what they do. Is this some sort of an obstacle in front of them, and they can turn around and, you know, schedule a new route, or, you know, something like that, or go around or wait, or, you know, there's loads of things that can happen, like, rarely, but vandalism and theft is not a big problem for us.
I guess we just assume the worst in each other and are surprised when people are actually decent.
Yeah, we also see that, obviously it's a very, very unique and new thing in the world that you see robots on streets doing their own thing. Yeah. And one thing that building Starship I've actually been very surprised about, or I was originally, now it's commonplace, but I was very surprised about when we started to doing our first tests is that how accepting actually people are towards our robots. When we have put the robots into completely new cities where people have not seen the robots before, and we just have robots drive on the streets and sidewalk and just see, you know, people just walking past, and they're not paying really attention. They could pay a lot of attention to robots, but they don't. They just very naturally accept robots as part of the fabric of their neighborhood. And it happens very, very, very quickly. Like there isn't really like a massive curiosity, or these robots do not really cause a lot of commotion. People just happily accept that, wow, they have a new way to get something delivered. It's a new experience for them. Like probably most of the audience here has not had a robot delivery, because we only have a few thousand robots and not yet a few million robots. And we're only covering Finland nationwide. And, you know, in most other countries, there is no nationwide coverage yet. So most of the audience probably have not experienced a robot delivery, but you will. In a couple of years, you will, I'm sure. And it's a completely different experience. It's with a human courier, like knocking on your door or coming to your gate or something like that, it's one type of experience. With a robot, it's very different. Like one thing, for example, robot has no judgment of you. It's completely neutral. You can show up in your underwear if you want to, you know, it's not a social interaction that you have.
Right.
And robot has time for you. I mean, the courier maybe also has, but you see, they're always busy, always, you know, trying to get back, which is completely natural, of course. But with robots, it's a different emotionally very different experience. A little bit like, you know, maybe, you know, remember, like there was a time, you know, decades ago, where people used to book flight tickets by going to a travel agent.
Right.
And you could sit down with the travel agent, explain, you know, oh, I need to go, you know, fly to Madrid, or, you know, and then they, oh, yeah, there's flights on these dates or these, you know, yeah, something like this actually used to happen, right? And now it's all moved to internet. Obviously, people literally book their flight tickets at 2 a.m. in, you know, in their underwear. and they like it, you know, even though maybe, yes, with a human travel agent, there was like, oh, there's like a human contact. They just want to get the job done. They just want to book their flight ticket. They just want to get their burger or milk and so forth.
Yeah, well, it's probably what you're talking about here, that people have been thinking for so long that this should be the next step in the future of delivery, that we're not that surprised seeing it because we just kind of expect them to be there. They haven't touched ground in Barcelona yet, so I look forward to seeing them buzz around soon.
Yeah, and maybe also because, you know, I said it's easier to name the delivery apps that are not our customers yet. So you mentioned Glovo. So Glovo is not our customer yet, but actually, is Glovo the only one of the major apps? Maybe.
Well, yet.
Yeah.
That's the key word. Yet.
Yes.
I look forward to seeing them. And on the topic here of talking about the robots, I think an important question, and something you're very involved in, so I do want to give you a chance to speak about it, is just kind of the environmental impact that these robots have, if at all, because, you know, you're saying we're growing our fleet, we want to increase, you know, be in every major city, these kinds of things. Then the honest question has to become then, well, what's the environmental impact of having a little robot buzz around? And I know you've had plenty of involvement with climate and environmental initiatives. I've got here, you're a member of a nature protection NGO. There was a Let's Do It campaign way back in 2008 where you cleaned the countryside. So I want to hear a little bit about where Starship lands on their responsibility towards climate.
Yeah, so Starship robots are actually the most environmentally friendly way to get anything delivered.
Wow.
So why? because the robots are small and lightweight, the weight of the robot is less than the weight of a person, is less than the weight of a delivery courier. So it takes less energy to move than it takes energy to move a person with a bike, or even a person walking, or for sure a person driving a car. So due to the weight of the robot, due to that it's small and lightweight, it's actually the most energy efficient way. Our robots driving take less energy than the nutritional energy that people spend when they walk. So therefore you could actually argue it is more environmentally friendly to use Starship delivery than to walk, or for sure drive, to a grocery store or restaurant. So there is positive environmental impact to this. I'm sure, you know, at some point, you know, there, you know, people will also be very focused on that.
When it comes, because you've scaled, Starship has scaled across Europe into the U.S. When we're talking about these kind of regulations about the way the little robot needs to buzz around the city, the way what kind of environmental regulation needs to meet, has there been too much of a difficulty between adapting that in Europe versus the U.S.?
So U.S. is more forward-looking, I would say, and moves quicker. Everything in U.S. moves quicker, I would say.
Right.
But we have had great regulatory success everywhere. Like we work with regulators everywhere. We don't just go rogue and just put our robots, you know, without caring about what the traffic laws are. Or you know, we actually investigate the laws and we talk to the regulators. Regulators over the world have actually moved to put forward regulations that govern robots. On the sidewalk. So most of the states in U.S. have adopted laws that permit robots on the sidewalk, and you know, under certain conditions, of course, like weight limits or things like that. And a lot of the countries in Europe have done it or are planning to do it. So we are operating in 8 different countries: so Finland, UK, Czechia, Germany, U.S., Sweden, maybe left out of Estonia.
Of course. Okay. So, maybe I want to hear a little bit more, and just because I think it would be interesting to maybe people who are listening to this podcast, if they're founders, people interested in kind of moving their company around. Has there been, as far as you're concerned, any particular difficulty when it comes to Europe versus US in scaling the company at large? Because we're talking, you were founded in 2014, so we're talking 10 years after the fact, more than 10 years after the fact, right? Has there been a kind of noticeable difference for you? Or was it, as you say, easy as both in the US and in the EU or Europe?
Well, I think in general, US has a better ecosystem in building companies. Mm. You know, more, most notably, there's more growth capital in U.S.
When
companies are raising, you know, rounds which are like 1 million or 5 million or so, that can easily be done both, you know, Europe and U.S. But, you know, when a company, you know, starts growing and moves, you know, more towards larger capital raising rounds, like tens of millions or 100 million or so, I think generally the rounds above 50 million, usually, even if it's European startups, they often or mostly involve US investors, because there are just fewer investors in Europe that are investing in startups or scale-ups that do these sorts of these sorts of tickets. So I would say availability of capital or the overness, savviness of investors is probably the biggest difference in US versus Europe. Even though, some people of course, have taken a very black and white view that, hey, you know, is everything much better in US? I'm not inclined to take views like that. I am European. I am building this from Europe. We have, of course, large US presence as well, and we are registered as a Delaware company, actually. I absolutely believe you can build successful startups in Europe.
Well, talking about the ecosystem, I had a look, and I usually do this for most interviews because I think it's an interesting tidbit, is I look over the funding that we've covered in adjacent areas that you operate in. And from a quick look in this past year, I think I saw, what was it, $77 million in funding going to startups that are kind of operating in, you know, whether it's warehouse automation or AI infrastructure, robotics, things like that. That's around the number that I've seen flowing around. So with that in mind, I just wanted to hear a little bit about where you feel Starship sits within the broader ecosystem, whether it's the competition-wise, how you've seen it grow since you began to now. How do you look at Starship?
I think if you think about, you know, fundraising, I think, you know, and you know, European capital as well, clearly, the trend is positive in the sense that European investors are getting better at it, and the amounts are also getting better. You know, Starship's actually in a place where we are fairly close to being in the place where we actually don't need, you know, venture funding anymore. Because it's a good business that we are doing, but also, you know, there's certainly lots of investor interest in investing in these types of areas, like especially, you know, anything around, you know, physical AI is hot topic among investors.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna leave you now, but with one last question, and then we're gonna call it a day on the podcast. I was interested, kind of, to hear about what you would look at if we're looking at a city fully ingrained with you know, autonomous delivery robots, because, you know, you've spoken about a grocery when you're getting ordering something delivered. What does a city fully ingrained with autonomous robots look like for you? Is it we're all sitting in our house? Everything's brought to us. You know, what's the kind of balance there that you see?
I think it's a combination of things. I don't really envision the future where people don't get out of their houses at all. I don't think that's what people want to do. And I don't see a reason why that would happen. Actually, in terms of, you know, how the cities would look, I actually don't see that the cities would be totally looking differently. Just like the fact that there are, you know, human delivery couriers running around doesn't make the city to come somehow work totally differently. But robots are the commonplace in many, many, many cities around the world right now, and they will become commonplace pretty much everywhere. But the cities will still look the same, largely. And we are also building our technology to fit into the existing infrastructure. We are not assuming that these cities and the sidewalks and roads will be built differently for robots.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for this, Ati. It's been a pleasure to have you on. We don't usually get to talk to that many people working in robotics, so it's been a very interesting conversation for me. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Thank you on my side. Thank you.